I want you to turn tonight to the 20th chapter of Leviticus, Leviticus chapter 20. I want to start off with an illustration, and this is probably going to, for anybody in the room that's younger than me, this will probably come across as a, you know, back when I was young kind of story. Those of you that are older than me will probably have a little difficulty relating to the theme of what I'm going to tell you. But I grew up, as most of you know, near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the state capital. And in the middle of the Susquehanna River, right across from downtown, is a little island called City Island. Now, back in the 1970s, there were two major floods that came through that part of Pennsylvania and pretty much wiped off everything that was on City Island at the time. And so when the early 80s came in, City Island, there was a little ramp off the bridge over the river where you could go down to the island, but there really wasn't much of anything there except a parking lot at the time. They've since added a minor league baseball park, and it's actually kind of a nice place to go now. But when I was 12, 13, I still cannot remember with any certainty the year, but we used to get the newspaper at our house. I know, it's quaint to some of you, but the newspaper, you know, newspaper, my dad would read it. And of course, you know, we would all jockey for the funnies and the sports page. But one Sunday, the Harrisburg Patriot News had a major expose about City Island. Again, this is the early 80s. This was before 1985, because that's when they built the park. And it was, I know it was before they built the ballpark. But the big expose was they found out, they discovered that City Island was a place where homosexuals would meet to link up. And they dedicated, and keep in mind, my memory of that youth isn't that strong, but even I read the paper, and even I recognized that this was kind of a big deal. Probably four solid pages of the newspaper that Sunday morning was dedicated to this story. And for the rest of the week, there were follow-up stories. There were letters to the editor. What do you think the tone of most of this was? This is a stain on the city. This is bad. This is not something that the good citizens of Harrisburg want. What if somebody announced today that, oh, the same place is a hangout for homosexuals? What would be the, I mean, why do they need to hide it? You know, the mood today would be much different than it was. I mean, when I was that young, I barely understood what homosexuality even in was. But I knew it was evil because I knew my Bible said it was evil. And my parents knew it was evil, and my church taught it was evil. But the point of that illustration is there was a day, and again, many of you remember this because you're, you know, like I said, my age or older, when sins were kept private. If a man and a woman were immoral together, probably few people knew about it. Today, you're expected to not only tolerate that kind of thing, you're supposed to not only, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for here? Not encourage it, but certainly not be negative or critical of sin. You're supposed to embrace this. I mean, these, you know, this is their choice. This is their morality. Their concept of morality, I guess, not really morality. But the wicked in our country today not only expect us to tolerate and even embrace it, they want us to repudiate our morality. The world always wants us to forsake the things of God to embrace the things of the world. That's how Satan works. As we look in Leviticus 20, we see that Israel has come out of Egypt. They're in the wilderness at this point. The people of Israel have received the law already. They've been to Mount Sinai. God has spoken to them. The commandments that they received and that we have recorded for us in Exodus 20 are addressed in Leviticus 20 as things to avoid, things not to do, things to forsake. And it's interesting that as the people of Israel are in the wilderness, did it ever occur to you that they don't have a lot of outside influence from the world? It's just them. They're in the wilderness. Did Israel sin in the wilderness? Oh, yeah, they were really good at it. And that was without worldly, the degree of worldly influence that they would have when they finally entered the land. Because when they enter into the land, we all know the story, they did not drive out all of the wicked people. They did not clean them out of the land. They allowed many to remain. And what did those pagans do? They successfully tempted Israel to sin. So here's Israel. They're still in the wilderness. Now, of course, many of them have just seen the punishments on Egypt that God inflicted just a few years before. Their children are going to be the ones to go into the land. And it's interesting that God is going to put before them a choice. You know, God says, these are some things that I do not want you to do. Now, keep in mind, we also are like Israel as they go into the land. We are surrounded by wicked people who want us to do things that God has very clearly commanded that we should not do. See the similarity there? Now, granted, we don't have the sacrificial system. We don't have the tabernacle or the temple or those sorts of things. But God's commands about what we read in Leviticus 20 are not limited to the Old Testament people of Israel. We also have to recognize that we are capable of sinning. You know, the people of Israel, even out in the wilderness, could sin. They didn't need the pagans and the wicked Canaanites to tell them what to do. They were fully capable of sinning all by themselves. So are we. Just because we're Baptists and we're in a Baptist church on a Sunday evening, that does not mean that we are somehow exempt from the possibility of sinning. We are fully capable of doing it. We are fully capable of serving gods of our own choosing and performing actions of our own choosing and just moving away from God. And so we come to Leviticus 20. It is a fairly obscure chapter to many people and a fairly obscure book to many people, but it is going to provide us with some insights about doing what is righteous and what is pleasing to God. Now, Leviticus 20 is part of a larger chunk of the book of Leviticus that deals with sins that in our day and age, many people would argue are private decisions. You know, if I want to do fill in the blank, well, I should be able to do it. Who does it harm? That's the sort of thing that we hear about many of these sins that supposedly are justifiable, but God unmistakably and undoubtedly calls them sins and expects us to do the same. But here's the theme, all right? The theme is this. God's people have to avoid the world's false religions and the world's immoral practices. And we need to be set apart to God and we need to follow His holy ways. And we're going to see that repeatedly in chapter 20. Now, the organization of the chapter is basically going to serve as my outline. There's four main points. The first point, and I'll repeat all of these for those of you that are taking notes, but I'm just to summarize. The first six verses, as well as verse 27 at the end of the chapter, all of them speak to sins that involve false religion, basically following a god other than Jehovah. Verses 7 and 8 exhort God's people to be holy. Then we have verses 9 through 21, and they provide a very specific list of sins. Most of them are sexual in nature, but these are sins that God's people must avoid, both the Old Testament Israelites as well as Christians of today. And then in verses 22 to 26, we're going to again see God exhorting His people to be holy and to be sanctified and to be set apart. So let's begin reading with verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, again, thou shalt say to the children of Israel, whosoever he be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed unto Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. And I will set my face against that man, and will cut him off from among his people, because he hath given of his seed unto Molech, to defile my sanctuary, and to profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do anyways hide their eyes from the man, when he giveth of his seed unto Molech, and kill him not, then I will set my face against that man, and against his family, and will cut him off, and all that go a-whoring after him, to commit whoredom with Molech from among their people. And the soul that turneth after such as have familiar spirits and after wizards to go whoring after them, I will even set my face against that soul and will cut him off from among his people. Skip down to verse 27, since it's similar to verse 6. A man also or a woman that hath a familiar spirit or that is a wizard shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones. Their blood shall be upon them. Now these can be generally classified as religious sins. All right? The people were to stone worshippers of Molech and wizards or those who practiced witchcraft. By the way, many of the sins that are mentioned here were also mentioned in chapter 18. If you were to go back there, it's interesting that in chapter 18, most of the punishments are not mentioned. And we recognize that the way sin is punished in a governmental way today is not by us going out and stoning them with stones at the local quarry. That's not how we do it. But think about that. Can you imagine what an example it would be if we thought of these sins as being worthy of death? To me, that's pretty strong. But it's interesting, even more so in verses 3 to 6, that God would cut off the worshipers of Molech. It's almost as if God knows what's going to happen in the future when he says in verse 3, "And I will set my face against that man, and I will cut him off from among his people." It's almost as if God understands that his people may not punish sin like he commanded them to punish sin. And so God will take the judgment into his own hands. It says three times in verses 3 to 6 that God will cut off the wicked person from among his people. And that's a pretty serious matter. And it's also a reminder. God judges sin. Now, God will judge any sin. I mean, it's not like there are sins that God judges and sins that God ignores. There are no sins that God ignores. But the fact that an all-knowing and all-powerful God is aware of what we do and is capable of punishing us if we, in essence, spurn his word and his commands is something that we all ought to remember. Now, unfortunately, the people of Israel were going to forget this. Solomon, it is mentioned in the part of, I believe it's 1 Kings 11, when it mentions that he married all these foreign wives and they caused him to stray from the law of God. One of the things that he did was set up a high place for Molech. Same God that's mentioned, false God that's mentioned here. And you know, Josiah, who came along 300 or so years later, and defiled that place of Molech. It's hard to believe that as you read the Old Testament that there were apparently 300 years of Molech worship going on with some degree of regularity before it's finally wiped out. And it probably explains too why Jeremiah in his prophecies against Israel mentions one of the reasons why God is going to do what God is going to do is because of your worship of Molech. But again, God will keep his word, and even if that means pronouncing judgment upon his very own people, God will keep his word. He will judge sin. And again, if he's willing to judge his own people, is he willing to judge us? I would think so. Now, thankfully, despite the fact that we are sinners and we have a propensity to sin, we come to verses 7 and 8, which are much more encouraging. "Sanctify yourselves, therefore, and be ye holy, for I am the Lord your God. And ye shall keep my statutes and do them. I am the Lord which sanctify you." Now, that's a much more encouraging verse. Because again, we're not real good at sanctifying ourselves. We need help. We need God's help. And so God exhorts them to sanctify themselves, and certainly, you know, there's a contrast between verses 7 and 8 and the verses that preceded them. But, you know, we see wickedness and we see holy living. We see sanctification. There's a difference there. I'm guessing there's an air conditioning issue here. Is anybody warm? I see a few people fanning themselves. I mean, I'm up here preaching, you know. Of course, I'm warm. I'm under the lights. I do this about once every, you know, 15 years. But going back to verses 7 and 8, the Israelites were told to live a particular way, sanctified and holy and following the statutes of Jehovah. And by the way, this is not merely to abstain from the specific commands of verses 1 to 6. That's part of it for sure. But they are to consciously and obediently and intentionally follow the commands of the Lord. And by the way, this is not limited to the Old Testament Israelites either, because it says there, you know, to be ye holy. Anybody else aware of any other verses in Scripture, maybe in more frequently read passages where those words appear? 1 Peter for sure. But we can actually go back to two other passages in Leviticus. One of them is in Leviticus 11, which I understand is the one that's actually being quoted in 1 Peter. Be holy, for I am holy. That's a command to God's people. Reading 1 Peter, I won't make you turn there. I actually will just read it to you. It says, "But as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy." In other words, at least in the King James Version, the word holy appears in Leviticus more frequently than in any other book. Now, a number of those refer to the holy place in the tabernacle, or to a holy convocation, or to a holy sacrifice. But the fact is, there's a lot of references to holiness in this book of Leviticus. We are to be separate from the world. We're to be set apart and sanctified. We're to be different. And there ought to be an obvious distinction between the lives that we as Christians lead and the lives of the unsaved around us. That ought to be obvious. People should recognize which camp we're part of and shouldn't have to wonder, are they people who live holy or are they like everybody else? I mean, we should be sanctified. We should be set apart. And by the way, we all have a purpose, and God has put a purpose in each one of our lives. And our purposes differ, and the person you're sitting next to may have a slightly different purpose than you have. Some of you don't work at the same employer that I work at. Some of you don't live in the same neighborhood I live in. Some of you have a different set of friends and acquaintances than I have. And God has given us different purposes, and we need to find those. But whatever they are, they involve righteous living, and they involve a life that is holy and set apart. Now, granted, there are some commonalities. All of us need to show love to our neighbor. All of us need to worship corporately with fellow believers, as we are doing today. But God has a right, and we have a responsibility, but God has a right to demand that we are set apart and that we do what He wants us to do and that we are distinct from the world around us. We're going to come back to that again in a few minutes, but verses 1 to 6 were mainly about worship practices and serving other gods. Verses 9 and following, we see a string of commands and a string of punishments that go with those commands for violating God's created order. Now, we're not going to read all through all of this. Verse 9 refers to a prohibition on cursing one's parents, and most of the rest of the section there deals with sexual sins and various types of immorality. And a lot of times, you know, we look at the Old Testament law and we read it and we're thinking, you know, I know I'm a sinner, yeah, but I haven't done that. You know, I don't curse my parents. I don't, you know, I'm not unfaithful to my spouse. I'm good, at least on this stuff. I may not be so good on other things, but I'm good on this stuff. But you know what? Look at your society around you. Are there various types of immorality that our society is embracing as perfectly normal and acceptable? There are. Now, granted, some of the ones in Leviticus 20 are still deemed repugnant by many people in the world. I don't know that that won't change over the rest of my lifespan or my kids' lifespan, but a lot of them are accepted. Adultery is mentioned. Homosexuality is mentioned. There's a variety of punishments listed, and the point of the sermon is not to get into the nitty-gritty about which sins were punishable by death and which sins were punishable by something else that is interesting, I suppose, and I'm sure there are theologians who have written about it at some length. But again, we should recognize there are punishments for sin. And God, by virtue of the punishments that He lays out here, makes it pretty clear how severe He deems these sins to be. And by the way, you think about the world looking at Christians. If we want to do another 80s throwback story, how many of you remember the names Baker and Swigert? What happened when they were found to be unfaithful to their wives? Well, a lot of things happened, but how did the world handle that? They mocked well, the two men who were the sinners, whose sin came out. But was the cause of Christ helped or hindered by that? It's hindered greatly. And, you know, I don't want to say anything that would lead you to think that God judges different sins as some are more okay and some are less okay, because none of them are okay. But we also have to recognize that certain sins are going to generate a bigger response from the world when they look at them. And that was an aside. All sins are contemptible in God's eyes. We need to remember that. But it's also interesting that these are violations of God's created order. Because think about it. When was marriage established? All the way back in the Garden of Eden. We did not need the Mosaic law to teach us what marriage entails. I mean, we live in a world where people are confused about what a woman is. And they're confused about what marriage is. You know, when I was young, I had a real clear idea about those things. I still do. And my kids do. And your kids probably do as well. But yet we live in a world that is actively trying to undermine God's created moral order. You know, God said, man, wife, have children. Children obey. Children honor your parents. I mean, this is not something obscure that the theologians that know Hebrew and Greek have to dig out of the finer meanings of the passage. No, it's very clear and it's very obvious. You know, God never approves of any other arrangement besides one man and one woman married. There's no plan B to marriage. There's only one plan. That hasn't changed. And if you're married, as I know many of you are, you need to be faithful to your marriage oath. If you're not married yet, or if you've been widowed perhaps, you still need to be pure and you need to be sanctified and you need to live a life that shows that you are following God's order when it comes to this particular area. But we had the sins referring to false religion, and then we had an exhortation to holiness. Then we have sins relating to God's order and morality, and we have another exhortation. So let's go to verse 22. Verse 22 says, ye shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my judgments and do them, that the land whither I bring you to dwell therein spew you not out. And ye shall not walk in the manners of the nation which I cast out before you, for they committed all these things, and therefore I abhorred them. But I have said unto you, ye shall inherit the land, and I will give it unto you to possess it, a land that floweth with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, which have separated you from other people. Ye shall therefore put difference between clean beasts and unclean, and between unclean fowls and clean. And ye shall not make your souls abominable by beast or by fowl or by any manner of living thing that creepeth on the ground, which I have separated from you as unclean. And ye shall be holy unto me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine. Now, that's a great verse. And I know we look through Leviticus and, you know, there's a lot of stuff in Leviticus that we tend to sort of gloss over because, you know, we don't do sacrifices. We don't go to the tabernacle. But this is a great verse, a great passage. You know, God's people were to be intentionally different, intentionally different. It says in verse 23, they were not to walk in the manners of the nation which I cast out before you. Now, the people of Israel had already been told there are other peoples, the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hittites and the Jebusites and all the other ites that I don't remember. I'm going to cast them out. This land is for you. Because they've sinned, and I'm going to judge their sins. Now, granted, the Israelites didn't completely follow their part of the bargain there. But why were these people being cast out of the land? Because of their sin. And then God says, don't you do it, because I don't want to spew you out of the land. In Deuteronomy 18, Moses tells the people this really in an even more explicit way, that God is going to drive out these nations because they are practicing abominations. In fact, much of the passage in Deuteronomy 18 talks about witchcraft and sorcery and this almost lawyer-like list of every possible variation of demonic activity that you could come up with. But it says there in Deuteronomy 18 that God's people shall be perfect, or if you have an ESV or certain other translations, you should be blameless. Because again, I am the Lord your God, and you are my people, and you are to be holy. Now, verses 24 to 26 particularly, they are to be intentionally separated. And we see that word sanctified a couple times in the chapter here. What does the word sanctify mean? Well, the general layman's version of definition is set apart. We are sanctified. Right? That there, you know, in our house, there are certain things that are set apart for certain purposes. We don't get out the fine china so we can have a midnight snack and some potato chips. Okay? We might get out the paper plates for that, especially if we don't want anybody to know, because we can just throw it in the trash and, you know, they get up in the morning and don't know any better. But that's not righteous activity necessarily either. But there are certain things in our homes that we set apart. You know, we wear our nice clothes for church. We don't wear our nice clothes to weed the garden or mow the grass. All right? We set apart certain things for certain purposes, and God has set us as a people apart. He set the people of Israel apart to be different from the other nations. By the way, the other ungodly nations, I listed some of them a moment ago. The Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, you know, they didn't all worship the same gods. They didn't all have the same cultural practices. I mean, they were multicultural sinners, all right? They sin in a variety of different ways, I'm sure. And, you know, God does not call us to just be a different kind of sinner or to be maybe a little bit better sinner than those other sinners. God calls us to be sanctified, to be set apart, and to be holy, intentionally holy. Because again, that's God's message. You will be sanctified. You will be set apart. You will make differences between the clean and the unclean. That's a reference to verse 25. You will be holy. And then notice the tail end of verse 26 there, that ye should be mine. You know, we understand the doctrine of eternal security around here. Once you're God's child, you're God's child. But God wants us to still be sanctified. We're not going to lose our salvation, but God does expect us to be different. Now, I realize, and I'm going to sort of start wrapping it up here, but I want you to think about several things as we do. It is easy, quite frankly, for a lot of people. It's almost reflexive to look at Leviticus and think, Old Testament law doesn't apply to me. I don't have to worry about that. Well, okay, we don't have to offer animal sacrifices. We don't have to observe the feasts. Most of us don't do anything differently during Passover than we do the other 51 weeks of the year. So, yeah, but this chapter does apply to us today. Because really, the two main categories of sin, the worship of other gods and the violation of the created order, especially in relation to purity, are things that God has also reminded us in the New Testament apply to us as well. But again, many of us will think, well, okay, fine. I don't worship other gods. I don't have an idol in my home. I don't bow toward Mecca five times a day like they do. I don't do some of these other things. I've been faithful to my spouse. I mean, I've been doing it for umpteen years now. So I'm in good shape, right? Well, yeah, I mean, maybe you are in good shape in those categories, but all of us are living or are expected to be living a life that is sanctified and set apart to God. Are we living that way? Now, I suspect in a group this size, probably there are some who are and some who aren't. I know we all sin, but is it the desire of our heart to live a sanctified and a righteous life? God told Israel in Leviticus 20, you be holy. He repeats it in 1 Peter 1, be holy for I am holy. And large chunks of the New Testament teach us how to live a holy life, and we can't just cover that all in a single hour. But we need to be different. We need to be different from the nations and the cultures around us. People should look at us as Christians and say, they're different. They may not like it. That's beside the point. God has called us to sanctify ourselves, to consecrate ourselves, to be holy. Because again, God has separated us from other people. And that's not a theme of the Old Testament alone. God's people are always to be different from the wicked nations. Now, let's jump forward in time a little bit. Israel eventually enters the land. They cross the Jordan. The book of Joshua takes place. Some of the wicked people are conquered. Some of them are killed and pushed out. They aren't all. And then we get to Judges. What happens in the book of Judges? Well, the people turn away from the law. They begin to embrace some of the wicked practices. They begin to worship some of the gods. Baal begins to be a thing in Israel. And what does God have to repeatedly do in the book of Judges? He judges them. God has to punish his people. Now, he sends judges to rescue them from the enemy nations that are taking them into captivity and doing other things. But it's interesting how easily the people of Israel just slide right back into their wicked ways. And you know what? Again, those of you that are my age and older, you understand it's even easy for a relatively righteous people, and that's in quotes, like the United States, to slide into wickedness. Now, again, we live among the ungodly. I remember my grandparents, and my grandparents, if they were alive today, I'm thinking of my mom's parents especially, they would be north of 110 years old. Okay, so when I was a little kid, you know, they would talk about the old days, which were really old days, because, I mean, they're my grandparents. And I'm a grandparent now, so, I mean, that had to be a long time ago. And you know, you hear the grandparents, and they talk about, you know, back when we were young, you didn't see that sort of thing. Or that, and that was in the 80s, folks, in the 90s. That was a long time ago, and you know, America hasn't had a revival to turn the ship back to the Lord yet. You know, we are tempted to sin. We are not, in any sense of the word, exempt from the temptations of Satan. And Satan can come after us, and Satan can make the worldliness and the ungodliness and the wickedness appealing, looking to us. He can try to get us to forget that the pleasures are only for a season anyway. But that's what Satan does. And of course, we are, being the normal people that we are, you know, we want to be friends with other people. We want to get along with our neighbors and our co-workers. And certainly we should live a life that is winsome and friendly. And we should live a life that would cause other people to find something attractive in us. But when the choice comes, are we going to do what is holy and righteous and sanctified, or are we going to do what everybody else does that God has commanded against? What are we going to do? On that score, let's turn back to 1 Peter. But this time we're going to go to chapter 2. I quoted from chapter 1 a moment ago. And if you get to 1 Peter 2 early, you can verify that I did, in fact, quote chapter 1. But in chapter 2 of 1 Peter, I want to start reading in verse 9, because, again, this is Peter talking to New Testament believers, people like us. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. That last verse reminds us, too, that when we live a righteous and sanctified life, the Gentiles, the unsaved, are going to see our good works. And you know what? That may bring glory to God. And that is a commendable thing. I mean, when you think about what can I do that would bring glory to God? Well, this passage gives us some ideas. And I would encourage you to meditate on that. One other verse or passage. Think back to Romans 12. I know that most of you could probably quote it just as easily as I can. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice. What's the next word? holy, acceptable unto God. And then the next verse, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. There's a difference. And one of the things, and I'll say this in closing, one of the things that grieves me when I see it, especially among young people, especially among the peers of my children, is when they look at the world as just another option. I can be like the people at church, or I can be like the world, and I get to pick. That's not how it works. God has called us to holiness and to sanctified living. You know, like the people of Israel were sanctified. They were set apart. And I don't want to give any confusion theologically between Israel and the church here, but that is something that we have in common. Israel was set apart. God's people in this age are set apart. Israel was expected to be holy. We are expected to be holy. And we should be doing the good works that the ungodly will see, as it said in verse 12 there, and bring glory to God and really draw them to Him. Because after all, what are we supposed to be doing on this earth besides living a holy life? We're supposed to be sharing what we are blessed with, our salvation. We should be sharing that with others. And if we live a holy and a different life in a winsome and friendly way, it has a lot more appeal. And the Holy Spirit can use that to others. So again, holy and sanctified, it is a choice. I mean, we don't have to. I mean, in a sense, we don't have. We have a free will. But are we going to live a holy and sanctified life before God and before the people?